what Football Fluke is doing. Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Ready to get into it?
Yeah.
All right. We're going team by team.
I would be very careful about slinging stuff.
Am I going to get sued?
Are we going legal on this?
I like football. I like football season. All the things that go with it.
Welcome in to the PFF NFL Podcast. Steve Palazzolo, Sam Monson. We're back live on YouTube a little later than usual here on a Tuesday, but it's because it's the Wests. We're breaking down the AFC and NFC West. We needed to give everybody time to wake up.
It's because of the Wests, or you've decided to do the West since we were late because you had a meeting?
I had a really important meeting, long meeting, big planning meeting.
Yeah.
And then, we decided since we're starting later, we'll do the Wests. Yeah, that's the truth.
I mean, it's 11:32 a.m. Eastern right now, but that means it's only 9:32 Mountain, and it's barely 8 in the morning over in the West Coast.
If we kept to our normal time, though, it would be that much earlier.
Right.
For West Coast people. So we're going to do the AFC and NFC West. We don't know which order yet, though. We don't know. Maybe we'll do the NFC West first. We'll see. Yesterday, we covered the Easts. AFC and NFC, though, broke it all down. We're going to go division by division today, tomorrow, and Thursday. Friday, so there's a lot of fifth-year option news happening right now. Jordan Love signing a new contract with the Packers, some fifth-year options getting picked up, denied, all that stuff. Do you want to wait till Friday, and we'll go through the week's worth of news after the draft?
Yeah, sure.
Great.
It's not big news. I mean, you know.
It's May now. We're looking for stuff to talk about. It's good stuff. Good stuff to discuss. So let's get into the drafts. We went through all the Easts yesterday, and today we'll go through the West. But first, the PFF NFL podcast is sponsored by Western and Southern Financial Group. While you focus on your roster moves, Western and Southern helps advance your money moves. Buying your first home, planning to start a family, wondering how to make your money grow? Well, Western and Southern's playbook of life insurance, investment, and retirement solutions helps you rest assured on game day. Team up to understand needs and address goals with a game plan built just for you. Get started at westernsouthern.com/PFF. All right, PFF.com, we have our grades on the website, pick by pick. But let's start in the NFC West. Is that allowed?
I mean,
there was a request in the chat, and I saw it, and I've acknowledged it.
You are at the controls. You're at the helm.
Let's start with the Arizona Cardinals. And, you know, they had one of my favorite drafts because of all the trades, because of all the wheeling and dealing.
Mm.
So the Arizona Cardinals, I think the biggest news is the fact that they traded out of 3 for an absolute haul with the Houston Texans. And then eventually drafted, we see Paris Johnson at 6, the Ohio State offensive tackle, B.J. Ojulari, the edge out of LSU, Garrett Williams, the cornerback out of Syracuse, Michael Wilson, one of your favorites, wide receiver out of Stanford. And then on day 3, a couple highlights there, Clayton Toon, quarterback out of Houston, Keytrell Clark, cornerback out of Louisville, Dante Stills, D-tackle at West Virginia. So I think when I look at the Cardinals draft, it's less about the players. Players are fine. But it's about the process, because if you read any 2024 mock drafts right now, Sam, you will see the scenario where a year from now, the Arizona Cardinals pick 1st and 2nd, and they select Caleb Williams and Marvin Harrison Jr. And I'm not saying it's likely, but it is possible that that happens a year from now.
Right. I mean, most of the mock drafts that are for 2024 right now, you know, they're using futures, win totals, all those kinds of things, odds for the number one overall pick, whatever it is. And right now, the Houston Texans and the Arizona Cardinals essentially are odds on to be the worst two teams in the NFL. And Arizona owns both of their first round picks. So, yeah, like trading back from 3 was always what they wanted to do. They weren't going to pick a quarterback. They therefore wanted to trade to somebody that wanted one. Now, as it turns out, it was Houston wanting to trade back up, having already taken a quarterback. So being able to trade back was big for them. Trading to number 12, I think, was a big enough jump that they were able to sort of maximize the trade haul. So it was kind of a dream scenario in that lineup, even though they end up jumping back up to number 6. But then getting the first round pick next year is just the absolute jackpot for them, particularly when that first round pick is coming from Houston, who are supposed to be terrible next year. So, I mean, that's a dream. They literally right now could have the number one and two overall picks, which would be the second time, I think, in NFL history that's happened. The Colts had it in 92 or whatever it was I told you.
That was Steve Entman?
Yeah, in what looked like one of the worst drafts of NFL history.
Quentin Coriat?
You imagine having the number one and the two pick in a draft, yeah, and it turns out that draft stinks. And there's just, you don't want to take anybody. That would suck. But next year, we're supposedly getting a good draft, you know, certainly with some quarterbacks available, and Arizona will be sitting there potentially with one and two, having still got, you know, Paris Johnson Jr., their new left tackle or new tackle of some description, and a bunch of players with the extra capital they amassed this year. From a sort of single move standpoint, that couldn't have gone better for them.
Yeah, if they do have a chance to pick a quarterback next year, it would be only if it's Caleb Williams, I think, would they even consider moving on from Kyler Murray, given the massive contract that they just gave him. But you have to have that conversation the same way you had to have the conversation to move on from Josh Rosen in favor of Kyler Murray. But yeah, even if the Texans pick is 5 or 6, they're still probably getting a potential blue chip player. So look, I've trashed the Texans a little bit. I don't know, highlighted how I think difficult it's going to be for Will Anderson to be the equivalent of four players, basically. You know, two first rounders.
I mean, even one
high
player.
Second and a third.
Like, the point is, you're giving up next year's first, which right now, according to the betting markets could be wrong. Maybe Houston's going to be amazing next year, but the chances are they're not, right? If the betting market is even vaguely in the right area, you're giving up probably the equivalent pick at minimum next year, number three overall, which in a better draft is likely to be a better player, or could be this, like, the chances, yeah, of him even being better than the one pick you're giving up next year to make that happen is not exactly a huge chance, plus the extra picks that you're giving up this year. Like, it's just, it's such a reasonable expectation for him.
We'll go through it when we talk about the South. But, you know, from Arizona's perspective, I think it's a massive win.
Yes.
They did trade back up to get Paris Johnson Jr. There was a lot of smoke around, hey, he's the guy that they want at three. So the fact that they did get him at six and picked up all the extra draft capital that they got, I thought was awesome.
I mean, it makes you now believe all those pre-draft reports, right? That if they were stuck at three, if they hadn't found a trade partner, if they weren't able to get out of that pick, they would have simply selected Paris Johnson Jr. at number three overall, which I think just further highlights what a great deal this was for Arizona. I mean, if they were willing, if they couldn't get a trade done, to just pick that guy at three, and they end up trading back, getting a first next year, in addition to some extra picks, you know, some of which they had to use to get back up to six, and still got the guy that they would have been happy taking at three. Like, that's insane.
Yeah. So that's a, man, it's a big win for Arizona. Paris Johnson Jr., the interesting thing about him now, 1 year at tackle, super long arms, going to fit in as a left tackle. But the Cardinals have question marks all across their offensive line, but they have probably four tackles and most of their questions at guard and center. DJ yeah. Humphries is still there under contract at left tackle. Josh Jones is the backup left tackle who struggled at guard but played well at tackle last year. Kelvin Beachum's there for a couple of years at right tackle. We'll see what happens with Paris Johnson. He could start at guard for a year yeah. and then kick out to tackle.
There were a lot of people a weird number of people that talked about him as a guard.
Yeah. Like
more than you would have expected for a reason that I never
really
understood.
Greg Cosell, I think, was one of them that
yeah, maybe.
Thought
yeah,
he was
yeah.
a little Greg bit Cosell, he was a little bit lower on Paris Johnson
right.
Jr.
So obviously you're not going to take a guard at number three or number six overall, but maybe he does last there for a year while they're figuring out how to juggle the four tackles that they have on the roster.
I'll say this. I think neither of us loved the tackle class overall. I think what, five ended up going in the first round if you count Peter Skoronski. So none of them had that truly elite tackle profile coming out, though, compared to others in other classes. But then as the draft got closer, I think because of that, I thought a lot of the guys would go in the teens. And then I'm thinking, no, they're actually going to go in the top 10. If you listen to what the Raiders said, I think they were probably going to take Paris Campbell at seven.
Johnson.
Paris Campbell. Man, how many times have I done that?
Just the first, I think.
Oh, good. Paris Johnson. They were going to take Paris Johnson at seven, potentially, if he was still on the board. And they were talking about Anton Harrison at 12. So the tackles ended up going, you know, there's a little bit of a run, a lot of runs in this draft. As far as day two goes, I know you didn't love B.J. Ojulari going, you know, 41, maybe higher than you and I would have particularly liked him there. Didn't love that second tier of edge rusher.
It's the right kind of range for him, though.
Like, it is.
As much as I don't love him as a player, that's where he was going to end up going. I mean, I think it might actually be the exact position he was on the consensus board, 41.
Yeah, right around that time. Garrett Williams, the cornerback out of Syracuse, is an interesting one we talked about on our cornerback breakdown. Incredible athleticism. Has one of our favorite plays, you know, playing basically free safety, replacing the free safety on a play for an interception, but has some physicality issues. And then Michael Wilson, the wide receiver out of Stanford. So that's, you know, not a bad haul on day one and two there for the Cardinals.
Yeah, Wilson, I think, is a really good player. I ACL tear in October, so he's, you know, working behind the eight ball to get back healthy. So obviously his 2022 tape is pretty thin, given October injury, et cetera. And elite speed, I think, is a bit of a question mark. Like, there were 4.4 flat guys that could just outrun him in a straight line, so that's not a great sign in terms of how fast he is. But he has that play that shows some really insane awareness and ability to make a play. He also has crazy sort of drive on the underneath stuff. He's really good at driving on those underneath outs, you know, hook curls, all those kinds of things. There's a lot of like positive stuff in his tape. So at that point in the draft, like, he could easily be a starting cornerback in the third round.
So, yeah, good, pretty good haul there. I think the Michael Wilson thing, you know, he'll add to this receiver mix. Now, DeAndre Hopkins is still in town in Arizona, still technically there. If they do end up eventually moving on from him or trading him, whatever it might be, Wilson has a chance to compete for starting snaps right away opposite Marquise Brown with Rondell Moore. See if Arizona has – they're moving on from the air raid. Are they going to be more of a traditional offense? Michael Wilson, kind of your traditional – outside receiver, doesn't, I don't think he's spectacular at anything other than, you know, running routes, getting open. You know, he's not great after the catch. I don't think he's spectacular speed athleticism wise, but he's just a good receiver that I think will fit in there. Day three, I like Clayton Toon, man. I like him as a developmental QB in round five.
I mean, he might be the best. He, I think, was QB five in this draft. Like, everyone was so focused on Hendon Hooker, who I think the NFL acknowledges, given his slide, was the kind of project people were talking about, not the slam dunk that the hype was talking about. Clayton Toon might be the fifth best quarterback in this draft. Like, he had a lot of incredible tape at Houston. Obviously, a lot of it was going to Tank Dell, which is going to help. But yeah, I mean, Arizona's quarterback depth chart behind Kyler Murray wasn't exactly amazing. Colt McCoy, who's probably going to have to struggle through however many games they get out of him this year with Kyler Murray coming back. Jeff Driscoll, who, let's face it, isn't really a quarterback. So Clayton Toon could easily be the long-term backup in Arizona.
So Dante Stills, I thought, an intriguing sixth-round interior defensive lineman from West Virginia. They added a little bit to the front seven. Maybe they could, you know, an edge, D-tackle, linebacker. Could probably use a little bit more. They had a lot of holes in Arizona, but they were getting an A-plus, you know, from PFF, on PFF.com, and all of our grades, because we are factoring in this case, the haul that they brought in. They're set up for the future. I mean, they're not only in rebuilding mode because of the players that are currently on the team, they're set up as well as any team for the 2024 draft. They're probably not going to have a great season. I mean, Colt McCoy's the backup, meaning he's the opening day starter right now because of Kyler Murray's injury. There's a world where I might just roll with Colt McCoy for the whole year. And
I think they might,
see what happens.
I mean, this is... it's literally the perfect scenario for Arizona. I mean, we talked about this is one of the worst rosters in the NFL. They're probably going to be bad this year, even just because they're not going to have their quarterback for the majority, if not all of it. They have all these holes to fill. They're sitting there at number three overall. It would be a dream scenario for them to trade back and be able to actually attack these needs and maybe pick up something next year. And it's exactly what happened. They got, what, one, two, three, four guys that probably end up starting games for them this year. A guy who could be their long-term backup at quarterback and, you know, who knows, maybe has a chance to be something else down the line. And they pick up the first rounder next year, which could end up being one of the top two picks in the draft. I mean, that literally doesn't get any better than that for Arizona.
And so just to put a bow on that, the Arizona thing, when you get to pick at three and you already have a quarterback, you cannot draw up a better scenario. That's the bottom line, right? They picked at three. The two teams above them needed quarterbacks. All of the power was in Arizona. There was a couple years ago the Jets were in this position, and they drafted Quinnen Williams. And Quinnen Williams is great. And I think you were referencing Washington a couple years ago, right? They drafted Chase Young. And did they turn down a huge package at the time, or there was reports that
Atlanta was desperately trying to trade up high in the draft, potentially as far as number two to get Chase Young.
So
Washington just wasn't listening to calls.
As tempting as it is to sit at two or three and say we'll just take the great player, we'll just take Will Anderson, we'll just take Chase Young, we'll just take Quinnen Williams, if the alternative is three or four players in premium spots, you know, in pretty good draft position, you have to take the multiple players. And so that's why I think Arizona wins the draft, right? If they had just selected Will Anderson, I don't think anybody's questioning it. It's like, all right, yeah, that's the best player on the board. You just take Will Anderson. But they weighted as we could take Will Anderson or Paris Johnson or whoever the player they loved was, but they, you know, you would miss out on three or four other players, including next year's first rounder. So great job by the Arizona Cardinals. Los Angeles Rams are up next. We might need an hour for this one. 3, 6, 9, 12, 14 total players.
Mm-hmm.
All between, they didn't pick until pick 36 in round 2. You could barely fit them on the graphic. Look at this.
Yeah.
Good job fixing the type to fit this all in.
At one point, I think they'd already made 5 picks, and they still had 9 remaining, having started with 9 picks.
It's unbelievable. I mean, there's 3 edge defenders in there. Nick Hampton, you know, you and I both love as a potential option there. Byron Young, upside type of play from Tennessee. Kobe Turner, one of my favorite, general PFF favorite, the defensive tackle from Wake Forest. Their first pick was Steve Avila, the guard from TCU, who has a chance to step in as a starter right away. I like Puka Nacua, the receiver from BYU in the 5th. Trey Tomlinson, the cornerback out of TCU, has nickel ability right off the bat.
I mean, in the 6th round?
Yeah.
Like Trey Tomlinson in the 6th is insane.
This
value
is why, if we can keep the graphic up for just a minute here, this is why I was saying, and I wanted to do the mock draft for the Rams, I said they have a chance to make an impact because I knew that a bunch of these players would be available. Now, they all have question marks. That's why they went in round 5 or 6. But the Rams could legitimately, out of just 5th, 6th, 7th rounders, find 3 or 4 legitimate contributors there. Davis Allen, a tight end from Clemson. Hampton, who I mentioned. Trey Tomlinson. Like, those guys can play. So I'm not saying the Rams are going back to the Super Bowl or anything, because they also have signed 24 undrafted free agent rookies as well. And it's something like 42% of their roster, of their 90-man, is now made up.
What was it, 38 players or something, or rookies going into this
offseason
training camp or whatever for them?
So the Rams are just going to be fascinating to watch because you know these guys are going to play in the preseason. We're going to get an opportunity to see them, and they're going to have 5, 6, 7 legitimate contributors this year because they have to, because that's where the roster was after the purge.
Yeah, I mean, look, this was not going to be an easy draft for them because they had a lot of picks, but the first one was at 36, obviously no first rounder, and, you know, it was going to be difficult for them to come out of this draft, no matter how many picks they had, and actually attack the number of needs that this team, this roster has after the kind of approach that they've had in recent years and then how that went south last season and the adjustments that they made, trading away Jalen Ramsey, et cetera. But, you know, Steve Avila, their first pick, number 36 overall, the first guard off the board, right? They went above Osiris Torrance.
If you don't count Peter Skoronski.
Avila was a guy a lot of people liked. He will immediately come in, be plugged in as a starter on this offensive line. If that upgrades that group, that's the first thing ticked off. Then they don't pick till round three. They get Byron Young from Tennessee, who is a fascinating edge rusher project. I think, talked about him before. Ridiculous physical tools, but really doesn't have much of an idea what he's doing from a pass rush standpoint. Is just getting by right now solely off ridiculous athleticism and movement skills. Has an interesting backstory. He basically gave up football, went to work in a Kmart or something. It was like a manager for a Kmart or a 7-Eleven or whatever it was. Had to go the JUCO route, ends up going to Tennessee. So he's quite old. I think he's 24, 25 years old, but he's pretty inexperienced from a football standpoint and comes with those crazy movement skills and athleticism. So in terms of a project of picking a guy up in the 3rd round and seeing if we can turn that guy into a legitimate pass rusher, I think that's a pretty good gamble to take. Kobe Turner, you talked about it on the inside, I think is a good pick as well. And then round four, they're the team that grabs Stetson Bennett.
And I forgot to mention Stetson Bennett. I apologize to Stetson.
Look, this was a quarterback class that was like a big four of guys you think can start. And then Hendon Hooker as the project, the guy that has all the starting tools, but the projection from that college offense is so weird. Who knows whether he can start or not? And then the rest, right? And the rest don't really seem to have starting a potential, really. You're looking at Clayton Tune, you're like, might be QB5, probably still projects to being a career backup. Like, that's his ceiling. If there's one guy that emerges from that group, you know, in 3 years' time, you're like, you were told that one of those guys was actually a good NFL starter. It wouldn't shock me if it was Stetson Bennett. It would kind of shock me if it was anybody else. Bennett is just that. Like, he's got a lot of that moxie that was a lot of the reason so many people liked Baker Mayfield. You know, the flag planting, the kind of the beating the dude in the head when they were warming up through his own end zone.
The DUI, too.
Yeah, that too. But there was a lot of kind of, you know, the attitude to his game that if it goes right is seen as swag. And, you know, Joe Burrow has this, right? Joe Burrow has been great. So it's like, oh, he's got that attitude, that winning edge. And when it goes south, it's like, oh, see, that's the reason he bummed out. He's an asshole. Bennett's got some of that to him as well, where he's got that kind of grit, swag. He had to do it the hard way. Like, Georgia tried to replace him multiple times, was a walk-on, had to earn a scholarship before becoming, you know, back-to-back national champions. But he's good. He made a lot of plays last year. He's, I think, more athletic than he measured, whether or not he was sandbagging that or not, or whether it just shows up more on the field. Like, that's a fun pick.
Yeah, Stetson Bennett, you're right. I mean, they brought in five-star after five-star. They brought in transfers, guys like JT Daniels, who's now like a five-team veteran in college football. Nobody could beat out Stetson Bennett. And then they went, I mean, he's a college football legend, now back-to-back national titles. The first national title with the 2021 Georgia defense and all that stuff, you're like, oh, you know, he's a passenger and all that stuff. But early in the 22 season, things did look a little different for Stetson Bennett. He's breaking out of pressure and making plays on the run. Because he's short, the same thing happened with Baker Mayfield. Everybody assumes the arm isn't great, but he's got pretty good zip on the ball for his size and all that. He is athletic, to your point. And it wasn't just he's chucking it up to like Brock Bowers and Darnell Washington. It wasn't just that. I mean, Stetson Bennett was good.
Yeah.
He was very good, particularly last year. And, you know, we had a little insight that QB coach at the Rams, Zach Robinson, may have liked Stetson Bennett a little bit. Les Snead may have liked him even more.
And now he goes to get coached by PFF, Zach.
And Zach is the coach. And did Les Snead call him like QB1 or something like that on ESPN? There was some... I didn't actually see it. I just saw people saying, like, oh, Les Snead thinks he's the best quarterback in the class.
Well, maybe he just meant that, like, you know, as of a week ago, the Rams didn't have a quarterback.
Or for the Rams.
Anywhere.
QB1 for the Rams who don't have a first-round pick and knew that they had no shot at least four of them.
Or simply, you know, he's QB1 on the roster right now because he's the only quarterback on the roster other than Stafford who isn't throwing. So, by default, he's QB1.
So, I mean, it's a fascinating – yeah, he is. Fascinating pick here, and I love it. You just put another Georgia Bulldog on the team at quarterback. That's how you won your last Super Bowl if you're the Rams. If I could just talk about Kobe Turner for a little bit, supposedly Aaron Donald gave him the vote of confidence too. Another undersized defensive tackle. He's got burst, violent hands, leverage, block recognition. Everything's good. He was elite grade at Richmond and then another elite grade at Wake Forest last year. So Kobe Turner was definitely one of my favorites. So look, I think we all tend, when we are looking at drafts, you tend to appreciate the ones or maybe value the ones that have a million players because we always talk about having more lottery tickets and all that stuff. And it's not going to be about hit rate here, right? I mean, you don't go evaluate Les Snead and say you had 14 picks and you only hit on four of them or five of them. That's a bad percentage. The point is when you hit on four or five, that's a really good draft. Because part of the strategy is drafting a million times and having those opportunities. And I think they have a whole bunch of players where they can have 4 to 7 strong contributors here. And it's a pivotal draft for the Rams because they're just trying to get back, right? After you have to trade Jalen Ramsey and release Bobby Wagner and you lose all this talent. So I like it. Anyone else you want to – Puka Nacua, the receiver, I like him. Contortionist along the sideline from BYU. That was one of my – I mean, one of my phrases there, but like all these guys have a chance to play because every position was basically a need for the Rams.
Nick Hampton was a guy that we both liked. He was, I think he was one of my sleepers when we did the edge rush rankings.
Same. We both had him as a sleeper.
Yeah. He's a fantastic player. He's just lightweight. He's like 236 pounds, something like that. And I don't know that he has the frame to be any more than that, whereas there's a few of these other guys that were lightweight edge rushers absolutely have the frame to carry more weight. They just haven't got there yet. But Hampton's just really good. He's got great hands. He's usually a step ahead of the offensive line. He can convert speed to power despite being lightweight. I'd like to see him with his hand in the ground more. I don't know if the Rams will do that, but he was like a stand-up outside linebacker at Appalachian State. But he's got like a crazy get-off. He's quick. He's got a 1.65 10-yard split, which you don't see on tape enough. Like, he's explosive, but because he doesn't have his hand in the dirt, you don't get that kind of coil and burst off the line. I'd like to see him deployed that way a bit more. But outside of that size, like, he's a really productive, really high-end pass rusher, and he has a real chance to contribute for them.
At a quick glance, it looks like the entire three deep of edge defenders for the Rams are first- or second-year players, which includes Nick Hampton, Byron Young, and O'Shawn Mathis, all from this class. Last year, seventh rounder Daniel Hardy and a couple other guys in there. So, man, the Rams are just going to be fascinating to see all of these young guys, right?
And
have a chance to contribute here.
Yeah, the Trey Tomlinson thing. Sixth round for a guy that a lot of people thought was the best slot corner in this draft. Despite the fact that he didn't really play in the slot in college. We just projected him there because he's 5'8" and 180 pounds, right? But let's assume for a moment he does end up moving inside of the slot. If that ends up being accurate, getting the best slot corner in the draft in the sixth round is a steal in and of itself. There's also a possibility that he can play outside. I mean, remember the Rams, as much as they kind of like the Jalen Ramsey-sized, you know, freak shows at corner, they're also the team that grabbed Darius Williams, you know, an undersized guy that a lot of people projected to the slot, but was a better outside corner. They were also the team that got our guy Troy Hill, another guy that projects inside the slot because he's
played
small, but might actually be a better outside player. Trey Tomlinson played outside in his entire college career, and his coverage numbers are good. I mean, he had, over the last 3 years, he had 28 pass breakups. He allowed a passer rating into his coverage for his entire career, 56. Those are insane numbers for a dude that's, you know, 4 inches shorter than a lot of the people he's trying to cover.
And the current depth chart is Darian Kendrick, second-year player, Robert Rochelle, third-year player, Kobe Durant, second-year player. I think it was Rochelle, then Durant. I mean, it's all young guys who haven't really established themselves yet. So
yeah.
Trey Tomlinson has a chance as a sixth-round pick to go compete. And that's the story of the Rams draft. Every single one of these guys has a chance at playing time here, and it'll be fascinating to see how many players come out of
it. If he's just what he's billed, it's a great value pick at that spot. I mean, he was the 69th overall player on the PFF big board, and they got him a pick 182. So if he's just what he's supposed to be, it's a great value pick. If he actually ends up being more than that, you know, one of these guys that can defy the odds and play on the outside despite that size, and he's got, like, the feistiness and the physicality to do that. I mean, he plays like a guy that understands he needs to outweigh the fact that he's massively undergunned from a physical standpoint. Like, he plays a lot like Antoine Winfield, like the original one, not his son who plays safety right now. Winfield is a lot bigger than he was, but the same kind of idea, a guy that was a great slot corner, but it could also play outside through being this physical tone setter and a guy that's going to be more aggressive than the guy he's trying to cover. So, I mean, that could be a steal.
I really liked the Rams draft, given what they had. And so PFF A- over at PFF.com. You good with that? Fair?
I might give it an A. I think I love that draft generally, given where they were starting from and some of the players that they picked up. Let's run. They've got to have some undrafted free agents worth looking at, given that they've got a million of them.
I don't have them pulled up at the moment.
Let me scroll. Let's find a guy that I like. Is there anybody that I like in that list?
I'll find somebody. I guarantee it.
Yeah, probably. You like that many people.
Actually, I've stopped liking people. Quindell Johnson, safety out of Memphis. He's did I pull him up? Late model?
Turn to the laminated board. Where
I have, hold on, let me pull up my I have a sixth round or later board. Give me a minute here.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, did I leave it at home?
A dedicated sixth round or lower board.
Yeah, I've got a couple views. I've got one that's just all the top seven rounds, and then I had one that was round six, seven, and UDFA.
That's what you need. It's like a priority UDFA laminate board. That's perfect.
That's what we'll have in better form next year. Quindell Johnson was somewhere here. Oh, Deswan Johnson from Toledo. I mean, they're Mr. Irrelevant, by the way.
Mm.
Edge, interior defensive lineman, hybrid. He could play as well. Not a lot of other guys that stood out there for me.
No.
On the UDFA group.
Okay, well, you got 14 actual draft picks, so they don't need to have hit, you know, too many undrafted free agents.
I'm sure they're great, though. I'm sure they're wonderful. All right, let's move on to the San Francisco 49ers.
Okay.
You know, we don't hear much about the 49ers. All their draft picks were gone.
Yeah.
Christian McCaffrey and all the wheeling and dealing of the San Francisco 49ers. So they didn't pick until pick 87. J.R. Brown, the safety out of Penn State.
Still picked nine times.
Yeah, they did. A lot late. The first kicker off the board, Jake Moody out of Michigan. They at least got, I think, probably the best one. Cameron Latu, the tight end out of Alabama, goes pick 101. Again, it was this weird tight end class where I think there was just solid tight ends. Latu goes a little bit higher than expected there. Daryl Luter, there's a potential sleeper type guy that I did like out of South Alabama, the cornerback. Dee Winters, the linebacker in round six out of TCU. A lot of people did like him. Production was up and down, but he has those plays where he flies around the field, and the Niners have done a nice job developing linebackers. Ronnie Bell, wide receiver out of Michigan, goes round seven, pick 253. Way lower than I think people expected there. He was at least a fourth, fifth round consideration, I think, on a lot of boards. And their last pick, Jalen Graham, the linebacker out of Purdue, is fast sometimes.
Yeah.
Has some speed on the field that shows up every now and then.
This draft felt a lot like the Patriots draft from a year ago when almost everybody hated it. And you look at the theme and it's like we reached or drafted players that were, you know, non-valuable positions, or we did both at the same time, and you end up with this totality of picks that everybody just doesn't like.
Yeah, I think, is this where, I haven't looked at consensus grades or anything like that. I assume not too many people love the Niners.
I doubt overall. It. I mean, they're, yeah.
J.R. Brown is interesting. He's a box safety type. I think every safety had people that loved him and people that didn't love him so much. So he was one of those guys. The people that loved him loved how he flies around the field and makes a ton of plays in and around the line of scrimmage. He is probably limited as a box type of player. You already have Talanoa Hufanga there in San Francisco. So again, in the third round, a lot of teams are not saying like, here's my projected starter. And that's what makes, I think that's what fans want to see, right? They want to see your first pick, even in round three. It's like, this guy's going to contribute right away. Other than Jake Moody, the kicker, who contributes right away for the Niners. I'm not saying judge the draft by that.
Yeah.
I'm saying that's why the feels aren't there for the Niners.
Yeah, I mean, you can compare it in a lot of ways to the Rams draft, right? Where they both teams had kind of traded away a lot of picks. They weren't picking particularly high, and then they had actually quite a large volume of picks later on. But one of the differences between the two is that the 49ers, from a roster standpoint, are just in a much better place than the Rams. So you look at the Rams, and part of loving that draft is, I mean, there's a pathway to so many of these guys actually playing a lot or starting right away, in large part because the Rams just had that many holes in the roster. And it's like, you know, they'd backed themselves into a corner where they needed to come out of the draft with quite a few players that can start or contribute year one. The 49ers aren't really in that position. Like, it's a good roster. So part of it is they're unlikely to come out of this draft with a bunch of players where you're like, oh, that guy's going to start year one, because there isn't the space.
There's definitely a combination of, because the Rams have so many holes, are we a little biased and saying, look at all these guys, they're all going to play this year.
Right.
And we look at the Niners and it's like, none of these guys are going to play because they already have all their starters.
That being said, I think there were places that they could potentially have brought in starters. I mean, that offensive line is actually not in tremendously good order right now. It'll look a little bit better because it's in a Kyle Shanahan offense, but you know, there's multiple starters in that offensive line that a guy in the third round could easily challenge. And yet they spent the three third round picks on a safety, a kicker, and a tight, like obviously a backup tight end because George Kittle is there, but a reach at a backup tight end. So it's a combination of both, I think. It's never going to look as good because the pathway to playing time for these guys isn't as clear as it is for some other teams. But even with that, you know, we were talking pre-draft, right? That the 49ers is actually a really fun team to use the mock draft sim for because they don't pick for ages. And then you have that sort of 3 and 4 at the back of the third round that can really do you something. And they traded up, right? Didn't they trade up for J.R. Brown? Like they were
at the, back of the third. I don't have all that.
They had 3 picks in 4, and that's not the way it ended up. I think they ended up trading up for J.R. Brown as well. So, yeah, I don't think it's ever going to feel as good, but even with that baseline, it feels like that trio of picks to begin with is a bit of a whiff.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how J.R. Brown does fit in there. You know, everything from everything he did at free safety, angles, tackle attempts, kind of ugly, overruns plays, everything he does in and around the line of scrimmage, physical in the run game, had a high run stop percentage. He did have good ball skills when given the opportunity. I'm certainly willing to concede safety evaluations that those guys can outperform versus, you know, maybe other positions where you trust the data a little bit more. But, you know, the data is okay on J.R. Brown, and it's certainly more conducive to playing in the box. But, you know, if that's what they get from him and then Moody as a kicker, I'm not as against kickers once you get to like round 5 or whatever. When you're a top 100 pick as a kicker, there's certainly more risk associated with that. Moody with two years, though, of PFF field goal grades above 90, that's at least a good start.
Well, he at least, yeah, like...
But that's why it feels worse, by the way. They didn't have they had 2 top 100 picks, and they used 1 on a kicker.
Yes. It's got to be the highest kicker pick since Aguayo, right?
There's other third-rounders, isn't there? Was it that high? It didn't feel crazy at the time, but... I mean, it's higher than I would normally expect kickers, but yeah. I don't know if that...
I mean, if you're taking a kicker on day 2... Which is what we're talking about. Forget day 1. Let's assume that should be off the table outside of the Al Davis world. If you're taking a kicker on day 2, you're putting an insane amount of pressure on that guy to be amazing. Like, but at least Jake Moody, unlike Roberto Aguayo, actually has, you know, the PFF grading data that says he's been really good the last couple of years. Aguayo didn't even have that. He just had a couple of really big high-profile clutch kicks, and everyone's like, oh, well, we can kind of overlook the rest of it. Moody has got a very good profile for a college kicker over the last 2 years. The problem is that the data would essentially say, not that it's random, but it's very difficult to predict who good NFL kickers are going to be. It's Justin Tucker, and then everybody else just has these random years where they're really good, and then they stop being really good, and then maybe they come back and be really good again, but... By that time, you might have gotten rid of them because they missed 2 critical kicks for your team, and they're on to the next team. Like Daniel Carlson is one of the better kickers in the NFL right now. The Vikings had to get rid of him because he couldn't kick for a brief period. Like, that happens to almost all of these guys. So for you to take a kicker in the 3rd round, you're kind of relying on the idea that he's going to be on the Justin Tucker side of this thing, which is pretty rare.
The other things to maybe highlight here, I mentioned Darrell Luter Jr. from South Alabama. I think he does have actually a chance to compete at outside corner where they're still not necessarily locked in there. D. Winters, I mentioned earlier from TCU, a lot of people did like him. He hasn't graded above 55 PFF grade since 2020. So again, he was one of those like, hey, you're going into the national title game. A lot of people are buzzing about D. Winters from TCU. The grades weren't great, but you know he's a 6th rounder. And then because it's Kyle Shanahan, keep an eye on Braden Willis, the tight end H-back out of Oklahoma. Maybe a Juszczyk replacement at some point or complement. So you've got at least a guy who really graded well as a run blocker, pass blocker in the 7th round that Kyle Shanahan might make use of.
So if you're
trying to skew positive here toward the end.
If you compare PFF big board ranking and the consensus board ranking to their actual draft position, they reached on almost everybody in this draft. Does the model like any of these players?
Darrell Luter.
Yeah?
Luter's the guy. So we had him as the big board I'm looking at had him at pick at 185. That's a 6th rounder. And a dark green guy that you would take anytime in the 6th or the 5th makes sense. Get him in the 5th. So that's why I'm saying I think he might have an opportunity to play.
Yeah.
And he was actually, interestingly enough, the guy that we liked, Mekhi Blackmon, who went much higher. Mm. Similar spot as far as model and similar spot as far as where the consensus board had them. But, so I like Luter.
Okay.
How's that?
Yeah, good.
For positivity.
There you go.
All right, let's. What do we give them?
C-.
C- for the San Francisco 49ers.
I assume is as low as we gave.
Don't talk to me. Talk to PFF. Seattle Seahawks.
At PFF.
At PFF. Go tell them. Seattle Seahawks started off with Devin Witherspoon, pick number 5. This is one of the first surprises of the draft. Devin Witherspoon at 5, the cornerback out of Illinois. Jackson Smith and Jigba, wide receiver out of Ohio State. Love that first round. Derek Hall, pick 37 in the second round, an edge defender out of Auburn. Zach Charbonnet, the running back out of UCLA, was their second rounder at pick 52. On day 3, Cameron Young, big old nose tackle type out of Mississippi State, goes in round 4. Mike Morris, another edge defender out of Michigan in round 5. And they may have gotten a starting center, Oluwatimi, the center out of Michigan, who a lot of people had going, yeah, maybe a round higher or whatever, but you might have a starting center in round 5.
Did you pick up on anything interesting? You've been doing your trawl through press conferences and media appearances and the like. Did you get anything interesting from Seattle's?
I did. Pete Carroll loves Devin Witherspoon. Now, the fact that they picked him at 5, you might understand that, but loves Devin Witherspoon.
Yes. The other thing I picked up, though, was they basically made it sound like they were very much in the Anthony Richardson thing if he hadn't been picked at number 4.
I did not pick that up yet. I got to a little bit of Seattle's press conference.
They had essentially given both quarterbacks on the roster. Both, by the way. It's fascinating, this sort of love that they seem to have for Drew Locke for no earthly reason known to man. But they were like informing both of these guys, you know? Geno, fair enough. Like, hey, yeah, you might lose your starting job. Drew Locke, it's like, okay, watch the TV like everyone else. You'll find out where you are in the roster. Anyway, they would basically inform both these guys that, hey, look, you know, this guy might be available. And you know, I wouldn't rule it out. Like, just be aware.
Would it have been Richardson?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
I did not catch
that. No, it was very much like if Indianapolis wasn't picking him, this was a guy they would be potentially interested in grabbing. And then when it became clear Richardson was Indy's guy, now it's like, oh, we're great. We love Witherspoon. Like, that's going to be our pick.
John Schneider was basically – he was asked if the first 4 picks went as expected. He said, if you asked me 3 weeks ago, yes. But then because there was so many rumors leading up, nobody knew what to believe. But he said basically like 3 weeks ago, if you said – you know, he's like, we knew something was going on with Arizona and Houston. I think they had some idea about Paris Johnson being in the mix. But ultimately, Will Anderson going before them, yes. Bryce Young and C.J. Stroud going before them, yes. And then Anthony Richardson going to the Colts, they're saying, okay, this is what we had expected 3-4 weeks ago. And then there was all the rumors about Will Levis and other things that might happen. So
this draft did get particularly wild before the actual draft in terms of smoke screens and rumors and innuendo. And I think I wonder if that's getting if it's getting intensified in this world where gambling is legal. Because before it was just like, oh, here's rumors. And it's like, well, it's you'd get, you know, like a 50-50 split of, well, let's buy into this. And that's just smoke, you know. Now the line moves. So it's like, oh, the betting line's moved. There's got to be something to it. It must be real. Whereas really it's just the betting line moving to reflect, you know, the money coming in, which is the 50% buying into it. While the other 50% are like, that's smoke. I just wonder if now we're in
betting
this
lines,
world.
Yeah, and because you can, like, anybody can have sources now. It's not just
– yeah.
Adam Schefter and Chris Mortensen with sources, it's like, oh, my hairdresser knows Anthony Richardson and the Colts might take him. All right, move the line. You
but
know?
I think this world of legalized gambling now might intensify the sort of pre-draft smokescreen period because you have something to look at now. It's not just this intangible, like, oh, here's a rumor, here's some buzz, here's some smoke. It's like, oh, the betting line just moved, you know, 500 points. And now we've got to start talking about what do they know? Why is Will Levis going number 2 overall?
So, yeah, I mean, Pete Carroll said something like, I'm happy for all those guys. Obviously, they did their due diligence, maybe would have picked Richardson. He was happy for all those guys who went. But Pete Carroll was raving about Devin Witherspoon. And it's not surprising. I mean, we were raving about watching him play and everything. But he made it a comparison to Troy Polamalu, who he coached at USC, for how he played the game.
Yeah.
And Pete was like, I can't compare Devin Witherspoon to anyone. Like, the way he plays and the tenacity and the aggressiveness, the physicality, you know, relative to his position. He's like, the only person that I think sees football through the same eyes all like the way he was describing it was I can't describe anyone else besides Troy Polamalu.
I never
which
made
is awesome.
Yeah, you know? I never made that connection during the process, but when you hear it out loud, it actually makes a ton of sense because the single best trait that Devin Witherspoon has is his anticipation and reading of the game. Like he's just ahead of everybody on the field almost at all times. Like he makes a bunch of plays where they almost feel like guesswork because he's so far ahead of it. He's just read it and he's set off three steps ahead of anybody else. That was Polamalu's entire career, yeah. Which again, you always spent the entire time going, is he guessing? Because he's guessing right all the time. Like, how is this working? Polamalu was able to read the game and make those plays for his entire career that nobody else was making because he read it. And remember, there was like a brief period last year where Hufanga was making a bunch of those plays for San Francisco. And it's like, has he got that ability to read the game like that? And it turns out with him, no, he was just guessing for a while and he guessed right for a sequence and then stopped guessing right and all of a sudden it fell off. But Witherspoon has that. Like his, it's so, you have to watch him and then almost any other cornerback back to back to see the difference in how he's reading it versus everybody else. He's so far ahead of the game. And then you get like his actual traits of, you know, burst to the ball, physicality at the catch point. He hits like a train when he does arrive. He's able to match and all those kinds of things. But it all starts with being a step ahead of everybody else on the play.
So Witherspoon goes at 5. And it was only a big surprise because Seattle had found so many corners through the years later in the draft. Of course, Richard Sherman, Brandon Browner, Byron Maxwell, last year Tariq Woolen. I mean, it was kind of like Seattle's thing, right? They never draft corners that high because they're going to find them and develop them, and they have a type, and sometimes their type goes undervalued because of the length and everything that they emphasize. And we know that the pass rush is a massive question in Seattle, and if Jalen Carter's there, you know, Pete Carroll might be a great person for him to be a motivator and, you know, get him going. So I think a lot of people expected Will Anderson if he fell, Jalen Carter if they, you know, felt comfortable with that, or Tyree Wilson because, of course, they would want the traits and the pass rush and all that stuff. So that's why it was a big surprise that they said, no, we're taking the corner. And again, I don't think we talk a lot about the philosophical idea of coverage players and pass rushers and how they're at least equivalents, you know, where the NFL might not always see that. I don't think this was philosophical. I think it was just they love the player. Mm-hmm. And they were willing to go a little bit outside probably their comfort zone of usually having the 6'2 super long guys because Witherspoon's so different. Now, they also mentioned he could play inside a little bit. I'm interested to see if they want to play more man coverage. You now have two completely different body types at corner with Devin Witherspoon and Tariq Woolen, where Woolen could take the big, powerful receiver and Witherspoon can take the better route runner, whatever it might be. You have more flexibility on defense if you want to tap into that. I love that potential option for Seattle.
Yeah, I would be interested if they kick him inside and he becomes like their nickel corner because of that the size makes more sense for them in those circumstances. But they're still without like an obvious outside guy if that's the case. Like maybe he becomes one of those players where he starts outside, and when they go to nickel, he's the guy that moves in. They find a guy that plays 300 snaps on the outside as the third corner, even though he's not, you know, the nickel corner who doesn't play the slot, I guess, would be the third guy.
Because he's so tenacious, you know, against the run and screen game and all that stuff, blowing up swing passes from cornerback Devin Witherspoon, hashtag fun to watch. And then Jackson Smith and Jigba at 20. You know, I thought Smith and Jigba would go in the teens. Mm-hmm. They get him in the 20s, and it's another draft where I think Seattle took expected top available players on the board, which is different from what they had done for so many years.
Yeah.
And Smith and Jigba, I think, is a great fit with DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett. He could step right in and play in the slot and play to his strengths.
This was a pick, I think, that would have been much more popular or common in mock drafts if anybody thought he would last that long. Like everyone had been, a lot of people had been giving Seattle slot receivers at pick number 20. They just weren't Jackson Smith and Jigba because everyone was certain he would be gone at some point before that. Like maybe as early as 12 to Houston, if they were still picking at that spot or somewhere in between. It just, I don't think occurred to many people that the first receiver off the board might not happen until number 20. And then Seattle's able, they come out of this draft able to take essentially the top corner and the top wide receiver off the board, which is an absolute jackpot scenario for them. And another situation where if Jaxon Smith-Njigba is just what he's advertised as, which is elite slot receiver, a guy that can be incredibly productive inside, 90% of his snaps in college were inside, huge production. If he's just that, it's absolutely worth pick number 20 for Seattle with DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett on the outside and a quarterback capable of getting the ball to him. But again, he might be able to do more. I mean, he does have the footwork, the route running ability, the hands, the size. Like, he's got all the tools to be able to play outside against press coverage. He's not necessarily pigeonholed into the slot. Obviously, they have Metcalf and Lockett already, so it's not like he just takes one of those spots, but he can potentially do more in this offense than the kind of the bottom or the worst case scenario, which is still absolutely worth what they paid for him.
A couple years down the road, though, as Tyler Lockett gets a little bit older,
right,
he steps in probably as the two. For now, he's the three. I mean, this is why I love being as deep as possible at receiver, because, okay, go cover DK Metcalf, Tyler Lockett, Jaxon Smith-Njigba, and Noah Fant, by the way, and his speed at tight end, and Will Dissly. Go cover those guys. Good luck. And then, by the way, if Tyler Lockett gets hurt, Smith-Njigba could easily be your two opposite DK Metcalf. So I love that for Seattle. As they get into round two, they had two picks. Pick 37, Derek Hall from Auburn, and then Zach Charbonnet, the running back out of UCLA. Hall, fascinating one, because this is where it became the Seahawks pick.
Yeah.
And now for the second straight year, they spent two second-round picks on both an edge and a running back. Last year, it was Boye Mafe and Ken Walker. This year, Derek Hall and Zach Charbonnet.
Yeah, I didn't really love Derek Hall as a player. He's very much a one-trick pony at the moment. That being said, the one trick has been quite effective, and I think that gives him a fairly high floor of what he could do at the NFL level. He wants to win with power and with his long arm move basically all the time. And he does for the majority of the time. Like, it actually works. It's got him a pass rush grade above 80 in each of the last three seasons in the SEC. Like, that's not easy to do. So even if he never develops anything else, he probably has a role as a limited situational, you know, one trick type of player in the NFL anyway. And if you can actually get the rest of it out of him, if you can develop a couple more moves and strings to his bow, then maybe he becomes a player justifying, you know, the 37th overall pick. So it is a reach, but I don't think it's a bad pick necessarily, because I can kind of see what they're working at with it. And then Zach Charbonnet, that's one that doesn't make a ton of sense, but in this world where everybody plays a running back by committee, et cetera, all of a sudden your 1-2 punch is Kenneth Walker and Zach Charbonnet. I mean, that's very potent backfield potentially.
I will say this about Derek Hall. 61st percentile pass rush grade historically against all NFL prospects. He has produced as a pass rusher, even if it is, you know, like you said, a little bit limited in how he's won. And then an incredible athletic profile. The question for Hall, the run defense has been poor. I think there's just a lot of room to grow overall as a football player. But we talked about Will Anderson not being this elite pass rusher, elite prospect overall, everything, trust Will Anderson to produce at the next level. But Hall has similar SEC pass rush production. So I think he has a chance, even if he is one-sided just as a pass rusher at the next level, to go with 34.5 inch arms, 90th percentile, ran 4.55, 10-yard split, 96th percentile at 1.55, broad jump and shuttle and all that stuff, really good for Derek Hall. So that part I get. I you know, as a developmental pass rush specialist, I get it. And Charbonnet, I mean, you know, say what you want about taking running backs where you take him. I think he was the clear running back three. You get him in round two with your fourth selection in the draft, where you already picked high-value positions at corner and receiver. I think it's fine, man. I think him and Ken Walker as a 1-2 punch become potentially one of the better 1-2 punches in the NFL now, for whatever that's worth.
Yeah, and then I quietly like their day three as well. They, you know, they understood that, look, our weaknesses are still the trenches either side. So they basically just started adding guys, multiple players, on both sides of the line, right? They add a guard, they add a center, they add an interior defensive lineman, they add an edge rusher. And it's like, all right, maybe none of these guys works out, but we're literally going to take a shotgun approach to the two areas of weakness and just hope in day three something sticks. And if one of those guys sticks, it's worth it.
So last year they found two starting tackles in Abraham Lucas and Charles Cross, Tariq Woolen, who looks like a potential elite edge, Ken Walker at running back in the second round. Is there someone else in there that was a heavy contributor in year one? Either way, it was one of the best draft classes in a while. This one looks like it could be up there as well. We're giving it an A. By the way, Oluwatimi, the center in round five, he's competing with Evan Brown, who they bring in from the Lions. He's competing right away as a starting center. If they find another fifth-round starter, Charbonnet will play. Witherspoon and Jackson Smith and Jigba will play and contribute. Hall's a developmental guy with all the other second-round edges that they have there. There's a lot of potential here for Seattle. If this is back-to-back years of really good drafting, Seattle could be a force in a couple years if Geno Smith keeps it up.
Mm-hmm.
If Geno Smith regresses, it might not matter, but they might be looking for a quarterback a year from now. But I love what the Seattle Seahawks did in this draft.
Yeah, I think it was one of the best drafts out there.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So there you go, AFC, NFC West, done. An hour in. We're keeping good pace with all of this.
Mm-hmm.
On to the Denver Broncos in the AFC West. They did not pick until which pick here?
63.
Marvin Mims only had five total picks, but I kind of like where they went here. Marvin Mims, the wide receiver out of Oklahoma. Drew Sanders, the linebacker out of Arkansas. Riley Moss, the cornerback out of Iowa. J.L. Skinner, safety out of Boise State, and also added center Alex Forsythe out of Oregon. What are your thoughts on the Broncos draft starting here in late round two?
I mean, it's difficult to dislike. They're obviously starting behind the curve because they didn't pick that many times, which is a decision in itself. Marvin Mims is a receiver. Every year you get these players where everybody seems to acknowledge and embrace the idea that they're just better players and they're going to be drafted in the position that they're going to be drafted in. Marvin Mims is that guy this year. All the analytics loves him. All the advanced data loves him. His athletic profile is outstanding. Nobody goes through his tape and dislikes Marvin Mims. So people looking at his tape love him. And yet everybody knew that the highest this guy was going to be drafted was like the ass end of the second round somewhere. He's a second, third round type of player. It's like, well, if he's this good, why are we, like, if everyone admits he's going to be better than this, you know, the back end of the second or the top of the third round, why do we draft him higher? That happens every year, and Marvin Mims is the guy this year. So there's a very real chance that he's a good player for Denver early. It does, of course, add to this already crowded wide receiver room and add fuel to the fire that one or more of those wide receivers may end up getting traded away. You know, they have Cortland Sutton, Jerry Jeudy, Tim Patrick, KJ Hamler, Marvin Mims, the guy they added from the Saints, Marcus Callaway.
Yeah.
So,
and little Jordan Humphrey.
Yeah.
Speaking of Saints,
they've got a lot of receivers. They picked up Jerry Jeudy's fifth year option. So you would assume they're trading someone away at some point, if not more than one of those guys. But Marvin Mims can absolutely come in and be a big factor in that offense.
That is, we spend a lot of time looking at depth charts and saying this roster looks good and this position group looks good or whatever. But the thing that changes sometimes is when a Sean Payton comes in and it's like, hey, this wide receiver depth chart that looks good, they're not really my guys.
It's like, it's good, I just don't like any of them.
Yeah, so he gets one of his guys in there. Does he have his Devery Henderson here in Marvin Mims? Next Devery Henderson minus, you know, about 2/10 of 40 time here. But the thing that everybody cites about Mims, which I think fits really well with the Broncos, is how well he tracks the ball down the field. There's a play where Caleb Williams, when he was still with Oklahoma, throws this like 45-yard back shoulder, and Mims, you know, contorts his body and makes the catch, and he does track the ball extremely well. And Russell Wilson needs somebody to catch the moon balls, right, to be a deep threat. I don't know if Mims is a good all-around threat, but he does have that knack for getting behind the defense, for winning down the field, and at the very least you're getting that. And you're talking about that skill set in the late second, sign me up all day for a guy like Mims. I am fascinated to see how it all fits in. They did pick up Jerry Judy's fifth-year option, right? So you've got Mims and Jeudy at least together for a little period of time there. Cortland Sutton's been on the trading block. I mean, if Sutton ends up being the odd man out, and they keep, say, Tim Patrick and Marquez Callaway competing for snaps, that's not a bad group if it's Patrick, Judy, and Mims,
yeah,
maybe. And then, you know, you figure out what you can get for Sutton. If you keep Sutton, you know me, I mean, if Mims is your four or competing for your number three snaps, great. That's awesome. You know, have as many receivers as possible. So I am interested to see what Denver ends up doing with this receiving core. But Mims looks like, hey, Sean Payton got one of his guys, and he's going to be a legitimate deep threat here for the Broncos. Drew Sanders, another, you know, another interesting prospect, top of the third. The linebacker class in general was not good. And Sanders only has 1 year as a true linebacker. He was an edge rusher conversion from Alabama. I think they'll probably keep him at linebacker, but just like they have Baron Browning as a kind of hybrid type of player, I think Sanders can do some of that and rush the passer in a pinch if you need him to. But he's a developmental linebacker who was pretty good his first year at Arkansas, playing a relatively new position, relatively inexperienced as far as coverage goes and all that stuff. So, I, you know, again, top of the third, I think that's a good place to take him.
Yeah, I think that's great value. I mean, he was mid-second round pick, maybe even higher than that, depending on which board you're using. PFFs was a little bit lower on him. The consensus board had him as a fringe first-round player, a guy that was probably going to get picked at the top of the second. So they've kind of got a round's worth of value in selecting him then, and a guy that will probably start for them, or at least have a major role on that defense and sub packages. And then their other third round pick, Riley Moss, the Iowa corner, who I think they're going to keep a corner. I mean, there was inevitably, when you're looking at a guy that doesn't have a perfect cornerback profile, and let's be honest, he's a white guy, you're immediately being talked about, well, he's moving to safety. Like the last white cornerback in the NFL was Jason Sehorn back in the early 2000s. Of course, this guy's going to play safety at the next level. So a lot of people were projecting Riley Moss to safety, but I think Denver's going to keep him a corner. And I think that's where he belongs, to be honest. Like, he might have short arms or whatever, might not have the perfect profile, but he's a good cornerback. He's not a guy that's, you know, a safety playing out of position, just getting it done in Iowa's defense. He's got cornerback skills. I worry a little bit about how he's done at the catch point, but I think I struggle to work out whether that's bad luck or a flaw in his game. He allows a lot of catches when he's in actually close attendance, and it tends to be because he's looking for the ball right as it arrives, and it sort of zooms past his head as he's turning to look at it, and all of a sudden it's a catch.
It just always gets by him somehow.
But I think a lot, like, so there's obviously a skill to that, timing when you look for the ball versus when you have your eyes on the receiver when you're playing man coverage. But sometimes it's also just bad luck. Like, the time the ball arrives just happens to be the correct time in transition between keeping your eyes on the receiver, getting your hands on it, making sure you're in phase, and then now's the time I turn to look for the ball so that I can make a play on it. If the ball's in the air early, you're just beaten. There's just nothing you can do about it. The timing matches up and it zooms past you as you're trying to locate it in the air. That just happened a lot to Riley Moss, and it's very difficult to work out if that was a problem with his timing or if he just got really unlucky for like a period of time.
So Riley Moss, I mean, he overall productive corner at Iowa. You get him in the third. The other guy I do want to highlight, J.L. Skinner, who you assured me J.L. is his name.
It's his actual name. It's not short for anything. They named him J.L.
All right.
The letters J.L. That's his name.
In my notes, I'm always, during draft season, on a quest to find the quote-unquote tight end eraser.
Oh, yeah?
Which doesn't exist. It does not exist. The best profile for a tight end eraser would probably be the guy who plays for the Chargers. Is it...
You've already jinxed him several
Derwin
times.
Derwin James.
You might as well, yeah.
There's nobody better than Derwin James, and that poor Derwin's been whooped so many times by Travis Kelce. So,
well, there's a difference between a tight end eraser and a Travis Kelce eraser.
Yeah, but I'm like, in that division, you should have somebody that you're like, hey, game plan wise, we should give this guy a shot against Travis Kelce. J.L. Skinner, the safety out of Boise State, he's not great in zone. He's not great with anything going over his head, but he's got the size, length, 6'4", he's got a little length to him to maybe man up with a tight end. So if you're Denver and you want to play game plan oriented ball against the Chiefs and slow down Travis Kelce, I'm not saying J.L. Skinner's going to do it. I'm just saying he could have an opportunity to maybe do that in the first game you play. And then, you know, when he gives up eight for 120 and a couple scores, it's like, all right, forget that experiment.
I mean, it's also there's a space for that type of player on Denver's roster. I mean, part of it is making sure that you have all the boxes ticked. Like, their slot corner right now is Kaywan Williams, who's small, like small even for a slot corner. So if you're sort of looking at your defensive profile overall, and you're like, okay, where do we match up well? Where do we have weaknesses? You know, what causes us trouble? Like, a lot of teams are able to put their slot corner on tight ends or on whatever threat emerges to the slot and be okay. Kaywan Williams, with the greatest respect, probably isn't one of those players. Like, you go, can he match up in the slot against Travis Kelce? No, he cannot. So if you're looking for another option to take, I forget Travis Kelce, but just a tight end that lines up in the slot, you don't want Kaywan Williams on him. You might want to experiment with a different type of matchup player.
So Skinner could be that guy. Pretty good ball skills, you know, decent coverage player. Zone stuff is a little questionable. So five total picks for the Broncos, B-plus over at PFF.com. Everybody agree? Let us know in the chat.
I've been slacking on the undrafted free agent lists. Who have they got?
Who do the Broncos have as we read on the fly here?
Oh, they got a lot. They got a lot. Who they get?
P.J. Mustafa. Thomas Incoum, the edge out of Central Michigan.
Mustafa was one of the few players at the combine to run slower than me.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Good for you, man. I'm glad that you have that, it's not even a hit list, but a list of players that you know.
Yeah. I can outrun a basically immobile nose tackle still.
I would say Thomas Incoum, the edge out of Central Michigan, is probably the most interesting player there. Thought he'd be a viable sixth or seventh round selection who could compete for snaps at defensive line on the defensive line. All right, Kansas City Chiefs. They kick it off with Felix Anudike Uzomah in the first round at pick 31. They get Rashee Rice, enigmatic Rashee Rice.
Enigmatic, good word.
Yeah, pick 55. Wanye Morris, the tackle out of Oklahoma in round three. Jamari Connor, cornerback slash safety out of Virginia Tech. B.J. Thompson, the big long edge defender out of Stephen F. Austin. Keandre Coburn, the defensive tackle out of Texas. And they round it out with Nick Jones, cornerback out of Ball State. That's Nick with no K. N-I-C, Nick.
Okay.
What'd you think of the Chiefs draft here? Pretty pretty straightforward.
Well, Felix,
seven selections.
Yeah. Felix was one of the two that I called during the first round.
You did?
I called Skoronski, and I called Felix during the draft. I think that makes a lot of sense. They were probably going edge rusher all the way through if they were stuck at pick number 31, if they didn't trade up maybe for, you know, the last tackle or whatever. If they were picking 31, it was probably going to be an edge rusher. And given the run, given the players that had come off the board, I think Anudike Uzomah makes a lot of sense for them. One of my notes on him was he has the greatest number of ways to win, I think, of any of the pass rushers in this draft. He has the broadest profile of what he can do. He can win with power. He can win with basically every pass rushing move you can think of. He's got enough speed. His measurables were better than I expected them to be from his tape. So he's got a pretty well-rounded profile, and he'll contribute. I mean, he'll make some plays at the NFL level, and when you listen to him speak, he understands what he's doing better than maybe any edge rusher I've ever heard of. You know, you can listen to some edge rushers in the NFL, and they literally don't even know the name of the player they're going up against the following week. They're just like, I just line up and beat whoever. Felix understands not just who he's going up against, but where their strengths and weaknesses are, where to attack first, and how to chain that from one move to the next move to counter whatever he's being hit with. He's a smart player, and I think that's a really good pick for them. And then Rashee Rice, the enigma that is Rashee Rice. I just love putting him with Andy Reid.
Well, let's circle back to Rice for a second. I just want to mention the Chiefs' defensive line right now. I need to study this. I don't know. It's a challenging thing to study, but the different body types that they have, right? Like Charles Omenihu, who they bring in this offseason, who has Tyree Wilson frame, basically. Wilson, who went 7 overall. Tyree Wilson's frame with the 36-inch arms and all that stuff. Chris Jones on the interior, who can move around. George Karloftis, who's a power player. And now Anudike Uzomah, who's like Gumby, right? Chris used the Gumby term. There's always one of those guys. I think Anudike Uzomah wins with bend.
Well, he also came back
contortion better than anyone else in this draft.
In the fifth round with B.J. Thompson, who's got one of the weirdest body types of anybody in this draft.
Yeah, it's almost like the Chiefs are saying, look, we're going to roll 7 or 8 deep on the defensive line, which is, you know, a lot of teams do that. That's not like Eagles unique or Niners unique or anything like that. A lot of teams have to roll 7 or 8 deep on the defensive line. But the Chiefs are saying, and we're going to do this with different body types. I want to talk to Mitchell Schwartz about this a little bit. Is it challenging if one snap you're facing a power player like Karlaftis, next player you're facing speed and bend, then you're facing an undersized guy, then before you know it, Chris Jones is there.
Mm.
And right, so Chris Jones has that game-sealing play against the Bengals in the AFC Championship, and he didn't win with power against the tackle, he won with speed, right? So as a tackle, all of the preparation you have, all right, here's the power player, and all of a sudden he's winning with speed. Or here's, I'm facing the power player, and I'm getting power. And then I got the long, super, you know, 36-inch arms guy. Anyway, I'm just fascinated by what the Chiefs are doing with all the different body types up front. And Adike Uzomah is going to play right away as far as the rotation goes. They're staying strong in the trenches, a place where Kansas City hit a lull for a couple of years. And They got back on track, I think, as far as their defensive line goes over the last year or two.
I mean, as much as Frank Clark made a bunch of plays in the postseason and had that kind of loyal fan base because of it, generally they probably took a step back by trading for Frank Clark. Like, that was something of an anchor around that defensive line until they got to the postseason and Frank Clark decided to switch it on briefly or simply luck into a few plays here or there. Now they have a chance to kind of reset that a little bit.
All right, now, Rashee Rice.
Yes.
We both struggled with him.
Everybody did. His tape makes no sense.
Even his I didn't check this one out either. The measurable stuff, he's another one of those guys where the 10 and the 20 are great, and the overall 40 was average.
He was on that list.
He was on the list, right?
Where they think the time is broken.
95th percentile 10, 90-plus percentile 20, and then a mid-tier 40 at 4.51. When he ran 4.51, though, I'm like, that makes sense to me. I didn't think he looked fast on film.
I think he does, but he then goes...
But sometimes he does.
But he then goes and screws it up. But he also had a 41-inch vertical leap. Like, he's explosive. So I genuinely think Trevor Sikkema's explanation for Rashee Rice is the closest thing to reality for why everybody struggles with his tape. You watch his tape, and you're like, there's so much to like about this. I watched Steve Smith bigging up Rashee Rice on a video somewhere today on Twitter, and he loves a lot of what he does. He's got that, a lot like Steve Smith, he's got that dog in him. Like, that dude goes out there and wants to compete, wants to take on people physically. He's got the high pointing skills, he's got the ability to win at the catch point. But Trevor's theory is he plays like a guy that's much bigger than he is. And wasn't he one of these people that was listed at some ridiculous height relative to who he actually was?
6'3", 6'2", 6'3".
Yeah, he was listed at like 6'2", 220 or something, and ended up being 6'1", 204, which it's a big difference. I mean, 6'2", 220, you're basically physically bigger and more powerful and more imposing than almost any corner you're going to be going up against. 6'1", 204, not so much. Like, now you're, you know, moderate size. You're kind of the same size as everybody. But he plays like a guy that is what his listed height and weight was. And the problem is that means he's leaving a bunch of plays on the table where he could just win with speed and explosion. There's so many plays where he blows past the guy off the line. And then what I think is why you're saying he doesn't look that explosive, because he then gets stuck up on the contact again. And I actually think he goes reinitiating the contract voluntarily because he's more comfortable with that. Like, I want the contact with the DB, and then I'll go up and moss him at the catch point, and I do that well. But if you just ran past the guy and got 5 yards of separation, that's more valuable because now you just got this much more space to work with, and you don't have to try and moss him every play, which, even if you're good at it, is a low percentage play. So it's such a weird tape because I think he can be a completely different player than the one he's trying to be right now, even if you want to keep elements of the things he's doing right now. Like, the catch point stuff is great. You want to keep that, because otherwise you end up with Quentin Johnston, who can run past people but can't really do any of the catch point stuff, which is why you didn't love him as a prospect. You also want to keep the kind of the dog in him, where he just goes and de-cleats a cornerback in the run game or buries him as a blocker. Like, that's a good thing to have. What you don't want is, if you can run past a guy, don't go looking for the fight again, run past him. Just smoke him.
Yeah.
That's not a bad thing. So
all that made me think, I want him on my team. You know, for all the questions I had on film,
I wanted to like him, but so much of his tape is scary. But now, like, if you want, it's a lot like, you know, Keon White going to the Patriots or Christian Gonzalez going to the Patriots. Like, if you have a dude that's he's got a weird game makeup, it's strange tape, you're not quite sure what to do with him, Now you're plugging him into not just the best offense in the NFL, but you're giving him to a great coach, and you're like, all right, you figure it out.
It doesn't mean every – look, we might overuse that. Like, of course, he's going to the Chiefs. They'll make the most of him. Like, but the Chiefs didn't make the most of Sammy Watkins. They didn't make the most of Mecole Hardman. I think they can with Rasheed.
I think they did.
Hardman?
Yeah.
I felt like they could.
Why do we think that Hardman's capable of more than that?
Oh, maybe they did. Maybe they did.
My point being, like, I'm not saying that means he'll be great, but if Andy Reid can't figure him out, chances are nobody can. Like, this might be an inherent flaw in Rashee Rice that for whatever reason he thinks he's Randy Moss, or not even Randy Moss. Like, he thinks he's Terrell Owens. And is going to want to be physical every single play, despite being 6'1", 204, not 6'3", 225. And is going to be doing that for the rest of his life, right? And is therefore going to be leaving an absolute ton on the table because he won't just take advantage of the 41-inch vertical and the elite 10-yard split and the fact that he could just smoke most cornerbacks off the line. You may never fix that. But if somebody can fix it, my money's on Andy Reid, and therefore I'm happy that he ends up going there. We might actually get to see what he can become at the next level.
Yeah, I mean, after all the question marks that we've laid out with Rashee Rice, I came to the conclusion I probably just want him on my team because I feel like there's enough in there to get the most out of him. I do expect that they will in Kansas City. It's an interesting receiving group, and now with Juju Smith-Schuster out, Mecole Hardman out, returning Kadarius Toney now for a full season, Marquez Valdes-Scantling, Rashee Rice gets to compete right in there with Justin Watson, Sky Moore. They bring in Richie James, too. Mike Bergonzi, the assistant GM, he was one of the guys that spoke to the media. Everett guy, Everett Mass, friend of a friend over here. So there's my degrees of separation. He was citing the after-the-catch ability of Rashee Rice as well, as a good fit.
Another thing that was in Steve Smith's video, one thing, somebody brought this up after he got drafted in the draft, you know, I think what happens is players get drafted and then immediately there's like a Twitter search for any interesting tweet or video or whatever on that player in the pre-draft process. And then those tend to, you know, they catch a little steam after the guy gets drafted. There was a clip somewhere of the podcast where I talked about one thing that struck me during the watching his tape is that Rashee Rice plays with that want to and that physical desire. And it reminded me of Isaiah Pacheco, who obviously the Chiefs drafted last year. And
look at you going viral. I'm proud of you.
Ends up becoming the starting running back and succeeding in large part because he just sort of wants it more than you do. You know, there's so many of these runs where it's like, God, like he throws himself into the contact so much. And there are sometimes NFL players don't always want to get hit. You know, it's the reality of it. Like, you're playing the game. Sometimes you just don't want that hard hit that's coming. You know, it's like, look, we've all been playing for a while. I'm tired. I'm beat up. I'm already like carrying a shoulder or whatever. And now this guy is coming on this routine inside zone play like it's the last play he's ever going to have in the NFL. It's like, I just don't want the smoke, you know? And Pacheco does that every play. And I think there's still value to that even in the NFL. And Rashee Rice reminded me of that. I just think it's kind of, you know, perfect symmetry that he ends up getting drafted by the team that obviously caught that last year for Pacheco.
Love it, man. That's great. Yeah, so I think Rice is a nice fit there. The other picks, Wanye Morris as a developmental tackle. Don't love him. The metrics do not seem to like him. He started out at Tennessee as a left tackle. He used to play against opposite Trey Smith or next to Trey Smith at Tennessee. Right tackle at Oklahoma. Historic first percentile pass blocking grade. So the right tackle spot, both tackle spots really, in Kansas City will be fascinating this year. They paid a ton of money for Juwan Taylor from the Jaguars. He moves over to left tackle, presumably. And now it's a battle between Lucas Niang, Wanye Morris, Darian Kennard, last year draft pick. All those guys competing for right tackle spots. Not going to lie, I think Darian Kennard could be the guy. But They have, is this the third year in a row between Niang, or is he 4 years ago? Niang, Wanye Morris, and Darian Kennard. Like a third-round developmental right tackle prospect in Kansas City. I think this is the third year they've taken one. One of them has to hit, right? I love a good developmental. I liked Niang as a third-round developmental prospect a couple years ago because his pass sets were a mess, but he had potential. One of those guys has to hit. That's what Kansas City's banking on here. I think Morris, though, needs a lot of work with his hands before he sees the field. So anything else from the Chiefs, Jeff? You mentioned B.J. Thompson, long, skinny edge rusher who was really productive at Stephen F. Austin, 92 plus pass rush grade. Kendrick Coburn as a big body on the interior could contribute as well.
I mean, I'm kind of fascinated that B.J. Thompson went as high as he did. Like, he went in the fifth round. B.J. Thompson is a wild project. One of the things to be scared of as an edge rusher or as a project type of player is not lightweight necessarily, but lightweight and long, like thin and lightweight.
Yeah.
This guy is 6'6" and was 240 pounds. So he's lightweight at 6'6". He needs 20, 25 pounds of more muscle. And he's kind of old. Like, I think he's 25. So he struck me as a very similar type of project.
It is easier to put on weight as you get older.
Yeah?
I'll just saying from experience.
Huh. Okay. Well, maybe, you know, give him a couple of years. Maybe he can throw that weight right on.
Jump on my diet, BJ.
But he struck me as a very similar project to Andre Carter, the Army defensive end who ended up going undrafted, in part because of that. Like, but he's explosive. He had really good pro day numbers, 4.6, 40, 7.06, 3 cone. Just struck me as a really intriguing project, but a guy that you take in, like, the seventh round, you know, because what the hell, let's roll the dice here. Eric Galco, he was at the Shrine game, I think. Eric Galco was tweeting me saying that he added almost 30 pounds from the end of the season to his pro day.
Well, he was listed at 6'6", 210.
Yes.
So if that was his legit playing weight as an edge, former Baylor player, I mean...
So the 30 pounds got him to 245. Like, he was basically playing at 6'6". 245
is enough?
But he was basically... Not if you're 6'6", it's not. He was basically playing at 6'6", 215, which is just absurd. Like, that's not an edge rushing body type.
That gets
it really
you
isn't.
The 96th percentile height for edges and 19th percentile weight
at 215 or at 245.
At 243,
right? So that's the thing, right? So if he's got to 245 or 243, he's still dramatically undersized. So my thing with him is, like, how much can you get on him? Like, okay, you already put on 30 pounds in.
He just needs to be a pass rush specialist. You could do that in the 240s.
No, you can't, really.
Sure you can.
Well, why is Shalik Calhoun not an elite NFL pass rush specialist?
He had flashes. I'm not saying elite pass rush specialist, just a guy that could put up a decent pressure
rate. Even still in the league?
He went through a phase where he was a decent pass rush specialist. That's a good comp. That's a good comp right there, Shalik Calhoun.
Right, but my point being, that's also a guy that washed out of the league pretty quickly despite being a higher prospect.
Trying to get it like it's edge five on your team.
I'm just saying you need that guy at like 260. So he's still got 15 pounds to go, despite putting on 30 pounds. Anyway, he's a fascinating project. I just was a little bit surprised to see him go that high.
Chiefs grade. What did we give him? B-, PFF.com. It's kind of, you know, I think that's...
Wait, they got some interesting undrafted free agents, I think.
They do?
I think.
It's probably
I might
a
have
B
imagined
for
that.
Me, Chiefs. You know,
oh,
just getting
they got my
the right
guy.
Players at the right time.
They got Denarius Prince, who was a running back that reminded me of the Isaiah Pacheco want-to kind of deal.
How many Pacheco comps?
Two of them.
Two.
Wide receiver.
Chiefs got the only two Isaiah Pacheco comps that
yes.
you threw out here?
Wide receiver and running back Isaiah Pacheco.
They're going back-to-back.
Who else did they got? They also brought in Todd Senteo, the James Madison, formerly Colorado or Colorado State.
Compete with Blaine Gabbert.
Yes, as a quarterback. He was an intriguing sleeper guy.
Can we move on to the Raiders?
I'm just looking through their undrafted free agents. It's relevant. They also got Truman Jones, the edge rusher from Harvard, who was Dane Brugler's edge rusher sleeper.
That was his big sleeper.
He's got some fun tape. He's a pretty good athlete.
How many edge rushers do they have in Kansas City?
Quite a lot now.
You ready?
Now I am.
Two more teams. Las Vegas Raiders.
Why are you trying to move me on from the undrafted free agents so much?
We spent a lot of time on the Chiefs. My internal clock was saying, throw the ball. Get out of the pocket. Let's go. Get rid of it before you get sacked. Raiders start with Tyree Wilson, the edge defender out of Texas Tech at pick 7. Michael Mayer in round 2, pick 35. Byron Young, the Alabama version, defensive tackle.
He went ahead of the Tennessee version.
He did. Yeah, Byron Young at pick 70 over in round 3. They get Trey Tucker, the wide receiver out of Cincinnati, who goes ahead
of his teammate.
Of his teammate, Tyler Scott.
The Raiders' entire draft is like drafting people ahead of other people that made more sense.
Ja'Cory Bennett, the cornerback out of Maryland in round 4. They come back in round 4 with QB Aiden O'Connell out of Purdue. I'm all in on that. Christopher Smith, safety out of Georgia in round 5. A couple other picks in rounds 6 and 7 as well. What do you think of the Raiders draft overall?
It was an interesting draft. I don't want to say I dislike it, but it's curious. So Tyree Wilson, number 7. We speculated before the draft and on draft night that Wilson might actually slide quite a bit. There was reports about his foot injury being a lot worse than anticipated. Chris was saying that he might not be ready for week one. Like, that's how bad it was. And Chris also referenced some doctors saying, like, that might actually be a thing that prevents him hitting his ceiling at all going into the NFL. It makes sense when you tally the idea that, remember, he was supposed to have an individual pro day workout because he wasn't going to get to his real one, and that just never happened. So that kind of suggests that the foot injury is at least still a factor. We talked about Wilson a lot. You know, the data doesn't really back him up as a prospect that's likely to be good. The grading doesn't either. The size obviously does. His tape is fun. It's destructive at times. It's also fairly one-dimensional and limited. At number 7 overall, just not a pick we think has a particularly high chance of working out. I mean, that's the bottom line with it.
Yeah, that's you and I. I mean,
yes.
Mike Renner before he left PFF,
and the data.
Trevor at PFF, both like him. If you just gave me the film and said, Steve, watch these 100 plays, do you like Tyree Wilson? I'd say overall, yeah. I mean, for me, I came to the conclusion I'd rather take him late first, if anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, the data does not back up top 10 pick. And
Ben Stockwell, our analysis lead, took one look at his tape and was like, don't really understand the hype for this guy. Like, I think there's a lot of, and the closer we got to the draft, the more people I ended up hearing sort of saying, oh, I'm way lower on Tyree Wilson than everybody else. It almost felt like a growing consensus that everybody was low on Tyree Wilson. But, you know, I think there is something too. There's quite a large minority of people did not love him.
So all that's fine. I want to, you know, on a positive note, adding him to Chandler Jones, right? So Chandler, I made this point draft night. Chandler Jones was also a guy who became more productive in the NFL than he did in college coming out of Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
Did it under, you know, Dave Ziegler's the GM here, Patriots ties, Josh McDaniels and all that stuff. So there's some similarities there. Chandler Jones on the current roster, I'm assuming he'll still be there by opening day, even with the big money that Chandler Jones is on from a contract standpoint. But you have Chandler Jones, Max Crosby, Tyree Wilson comes in. They can ease him into the mix. Dave Ziegler and then Champ Kelly, the assistant GM, we're talking about his versatility, ability to play up and down the defensive line. I will say Tyree Wilson plays hard and he's explosive. And I always think about the division matchups. When you're trying to beat the Chiefs, and we talk a lot about when you're facing the Chiefs, do you really want to rush Mahomes too much? Because as soon as you get out of your pass rush lane, boom, he's stepping up in and around. I wonder how much Tyree Wilson's length could really help with that if you kind of mush rush him and then, you know, you try to work the escape lane route that for Mahomes and Wilson's real. It's a very specific thing here, Sam.
But
I think Tyree Wilson could be very good at that in particular in the Chiefs matchups.
I actually feel like he's exactly the type of defensive end that will never get Patrick Mahomes on the ground. I'm not going to say he will never sack Patrick Mahomes, but you know the way Mahomes is always a tenth of a second faster than whoever's chasing him?
Yes.
There's limits to that, right? If Nolan Smith is chasing down Patrick Mahomes, he's getting to him eventually, right? I don't know that Tyree Wilson is. Tyree Wilson strikes me as the kind of guy that will spend 45 yards running in a lazy S right behind Patrick Mahomes.
Maybe. This isn't a running thing. This is a more like Wilson, because of his length, he's going to compress the pocket. And then if Mahomes tries to escape through your gaps, I've got the wingspan to grab you.
But start it in the pocket. Like, draw this S, right? We're in the pocket now, and then Mahomes is going to spin out to the left, right? This is the bottom of the backwards S, I guess. So he's going to spin out left. He's then going to loop all the way back to the right, like over the middle of the field, past the linebackers. Then he's going to start looping left again. We're going to get deep into the secondary at this point. He's going to end up with like a 25-yard run here, having taken Tyree Wilson on like a big S curve all the way through the entire defense, never getting his hands on him. That's what's going to happen.
Can't wait for Chiefs Raiders next year.
I don't know. We've said this all the way through the draft process. Didn't love Tyree Wilson conceptually. I think this draft to me is a combination of the Raiders generally seeming to reach relative to consensus, which is obviously something they've had a track record of, albeit with different people in charge. And then even the players they drafted that weren't reaches were usually players that I just didn't love, which makes me predisposed to not love this draft.
So so they got Wilson at 7. I mean, that was kind of chalk. That was expected. They did highlight, you never hear this really from executives, Ziegler did say we were comfortable taking Paris Johnson there. And it was another one, like, as the draft got closer, Sam, I started to visualize the tackles in the top 10 way more than I had leading up to it. I really wonder if Paris Johnson would have been the pick there if he hadn't gone at 6 for the Raiders, because they said, hey, we were comfortable with Paris. We were comfortable with Tyree Wilson there. They loved him. I mean, they raved about Wilson and his visit and all that stuff. I know you hear that a lot at these times, but can't wait to watch his development, even though the numbers aren't great for Tyree Wilson as far as projecting him. The Michael Mayer pick, look, he was expected to go in the first.
So that's
and they traded up to get him in the second, right? They went and targeted him.
That's the classic example, right? That's maybe the one pick or certainly the clearest example where they got real value. I mean, a lot of people expected Mayer to go in the first. A lot of people thought he was the best tight end available. They get him at pick number 35 in the second round. Great value. I just think that there's a reason Mayer went towards the second round rather than the first round. I didn't love his tape as much as other people, and I was particularly perturbed by him showing up and being both shorter and lighter by a significant margin than he was supposed to be. I just feel like that kind of took away his trump card, which is, all right, I'm not getting amazing. I'm not going to beat people for speed, quickness, but I'm huge. Like, I can go out there and be like win the way Gronk did, which is just beating people for size and overwhelming them physically. But then he shows up 15 pounds smaller than that, still ran slow. I just don't love Mayer as a player, but you can't argue with the value. I think that's great value for them.
It's an intriguing group of pass catchers now. Devontae Adams as your top wide receiver, Jacoby Myers as your two, good route runner, good fit as a two, Hunter Renfrow work in the slot if he's still around. And then your two tight ends that you've brought in, Michael Mayer, well, three that you've brought in, really, Michael Mayer and Austin Hooper, and also O.J. Howard, because everyone should take an O.J. Howard flyer just in case he figures it out here in like year 6 or 7. But Michael Mayer and Austin Hooper to go with the trio of wide receivers, that's solid. Philip Dorsett as your deep threat could be good for Josh McDaniels and Jimmy Garoppolo under center. Byron Young, he has multi-gap ability on the defensive line. You could tell, I think they were focused on improving the defensive line. They have so many holes on the defensive side for like the 5th or 6th straight year for the Raiders. I think at least attacking the defensive line with a couple picks does make sense here.
Yep.
It was interesting about the Trey Tucker pick. So it's pick 100. And if there is a complaint that I have with how NFL teams work the board and all that stuff, they picked Trey Tucker at pick 100 and they were like, he's a dual returner. Mm-hmm. So punt return, kick return, gunner.
Kick return at this point is basically irrelevant if you're an NFL team.
Yeah. Look, I would – when I get my GM job
– punt returner, Sam, sure, but kick return.
But when I get my GM job, I'm going to get in the building and ask the football people, how many special teams positions can we cut? Just not even focus on. Is it better to build my roster with two extra quarterbacks just in case they – like Aiden O'Connell, love that pick. That dude could be awesome. I mean, there's a small chance, but he could be amazing. The payout could be incredible. The payout of like a gunner, just don't suck on special teams, should be the goal. Mm. But I would ask the football people, like, how many special teams positions can we just neglect and still get away with it? And because there's fewer kick returns in the NFL, I will say there are way more kick returns as you get into December and January. A little underrated note, it's about 25% higher December and January when the games matter more, weather and all that stuff. So it does matter a little bit more then. But do I really want to spend a top 100 pick when I'm already a not good roster on special teams? I don't know. And because that's essentially what they did with Trey Tucker here at round 3, pick 100.
Yeah. I mean, that feels like a pretty massive reach relative to other receivers that were available, even his own teammate. I will say, so I don't like this draft generally. I did like Jacorian Bennett. I think he's a good player. I had him, I think he's the 4th best slot defender. 5th, I guess, if you could put Brian Branch in that category. But 4th best slot corner in this draft. And another guy that played primarily outside, so could be able to survive on the outside as well. And then, but I suspect can kick inside and become a really good slot. But like he understands zone coverage really well, like falls off one guy, gets back into the threat behind him. Plays through receiver's hands. Like he's smaller, undersized a little bit, but he's not going to just let a guy moss him at the catch point. He's going to keep fighting, breaks up a lot of passes that way. He also had a few dropped interceptions, like could have had much better numbers. I suspect his hands aren't great, but you know, whatever. I like that. I think he's a good player, and I think that's a good value. Now, where he fits in this defense, a little bit more questionable, but round four, good value. Like that pick.
Really athletic, man. And I think, you know, you take those athletic upside type of players in the fourth round. Mm-hmm. I'm all for that.
All right, give me your Aiden O'Connell breakdown.
You've laid it out pretty well. The big-time throws are out of this world.
It looks like different – like you watch his big-time throws and then his turnover-worthy plays, the reels back-to-back, it looks like different players. Like you would actually easily convince me those are different human beings because all the things that you would have written down on the big-time throws, which aren't just like, hey, here's a – there are some teams, quarterbacks, offenses where the big-time throws are essentially can you hit a moving target? There's very little – to it, right? It's drop back, look for your number one read. He's open. Now I just need to hit him with the ball 40 yards downfield. So on the other hand, there are other big time throws where, you know, he's got to work through a progression. He's got to maneuver in the pocket. He's got to hit a tight window. He's got to, you know, navigate layering a throw over a linebacker in front of a safety, blah, blah, blah. Like there are different varieties of those. Aiden O'Connell's big time throws, like you'll be writing down stuff about how he's able to manipulate defenders, how he's able to, you know, layer the throw past defenders, how he's able to squeeze it in through tight windows, vary the trajectory, the power, all these kinds of things. Writing down all these things, all of which are invalidated by his turnover-worthy play reel, where it's like, what the hell are you doing? Like you're the first one, it's like, oh, he sees this linebacker, delays a split second, layers it over the top of the second guy, hits him in stride. And then his first, like, turnover, he just, like, buries the ball into the face mask of the linebacker that's standing 10 yards in front of him.
Coach that out of him, Sam.
What the hell is happening?
Coach that out of him. This is, you've described a Jameis Winston-ish,
and
that's why I love it. I chase the upside with these quarterbacks. I think Aiden O'Connell, when you look at the guys that Josh McDaniels and, say, the Patriots regime through the years have tried to develop, like Ryan Mallett got there before McDaniels came back, I believe, but there was a little crossover there. Jarrett Stidham, both with New England and then last year with the Raiders, McDaniels. I think Aiden O'Connell could be the best developmental quarterback that Josh McDaniels has had. I don't know who I'm missing off the top of my head, but he could be the best developmental guy in the fourth round. I love this. I love it. Aiden O'Connell is going to start NFL football games, and it's going to be exciting. It's going to be a Thursday night game. Aiden O'Connell's getting the start. Jimmy G's banged up, you know. That's what happens. Aiden O'Connell's getting the start. And he's going to, like Stidham did, take the Chiefs to the wire and all that. And there's think pieces about, is Aiden O'Connell the future for Josh McDaniels and the Raiders? All that stuff's going to happen at some point. I would pay to see O'Connell at training camp. I want to go watch him in training camp.
It is going to happen.
With the Raiders.
We're going to get like four games out of Aiden O'Connell this year.
And I'm excited for it. I'm here for it.
And then we're going to start hearing about whether he's the future or not.
If you know, Aiden O'Connell and Charlie Jones, every time you're scouting Big Ten corners and it's like O'Connell to Jones. You're seeing that all the time, right? So he grew on me more and more as I watched Big Ten cornerbacks go up against Purdue. Mm-hmm. Christopher Smith, the safety out of Georgia, also really productive safety. Not a great athlete type of guy, but like I think he could maybe make a contribution as a fifth rounder. So I'm lukewarm on the Raiders draft. You know, again, people know my Tyree Wilson numbers and projections, and I don't love him as a top 10 pick. That's going to be the biggest thing, but I do love Mayer in the second. So PFF went B- with Trevor liking Tyree Wilson and everything that he brings to the table. So
yeah, I mean, I think generally they've fallen foul of the biggest risk right now of drafting, which is reaches. If you are reaching relative to the consensus board by a significant margin, most picks, you might be in trouble. So the Mayer one obviously.
But they didn't in pick one and two. So, and Byron Young, was he that much higher?
Yeah.
That
was,
you go?
It was like 100 and something.
We didn't have Byron Young. Yeah, 122. That wasn't that far. I didn't see
that's
reaches there.
Pretty
I
don't, big reach.
What?
That's a pretty big reach.
To 90?
70.
70. Okay. Yeah, I thought it was 90.
No.
Yeah, I think the bees are fine for the Raiders. I'm going to pick up my stylus here.
Okay, you do that.
We talk about the Los Angeles Chargers.
Let me know how it goes.
Do you want to read off the Chargers picks?
Once it comes on the screen, sure. There we go. Pick number one, Quentin Johnston, wide receiver from TCU. Second round, Tuli Tuipulotu, the edge rusher from USC. Third round, Dan Henley, the Washington State linebacker. Fourth round, Darius Davis, wide receiver from TCU, the other wide receiver from TCU. Fifth round, did they just have one pick in every round? They just did it like just vanilla drafting.
The Chiefs, like the Chiefs
yeah.
did.
Round yeah. five, Jordan McFadden, the tackle from Clemson. Round six, Scott Matlock, defensive tackle from Boise State. And their round seven pick, Max Duggan, the TCU quarterback. Because you've already drafted his receivers, you might as well bring the quarterback in.
I mixed up my note here from the press conferences. It was Darius Davis from TCU who was described as a quote-unquote dual returner for the Chargers. So that's who they got. I mean, Turner, though, the receiver for the Raiders, is still going to be – he's going to be like a yak gimmick type of guy, return ability and all that stuff. Same idea, though. But, yeah, they got three TCU players. 43% of their draft was TCU. Max Duggan.
Including the quarterback.
Darius Davis and Quentin Johnston.
I don't really understand why you draft Max Duggan, but okay.
So we had talked quite a bit about the Chargers' need for speed this offseason, and they did attack that with the two TCU wide receivers for sure.
Yeah.
Quentin Johnston, look, I mentioned we talked about it, the draft recap show, which is still up there, night one recap. A lot of good fits. And a lot of receivers who step into number three roles. Jackson Smith and Jigba in Seattle. Zay Flowers with the Baltimore Ravens, probably. But Quentin Johnston coming in now as a complement to Mike Williams and Keenan Allen, I love this. You know, for all of the flaws of Quentin Johnston maybe not winning enough down the field, his ball skills and all that fun stuff, he is quick and fast for a big guy. Big, strong, fast. Is what Tom Telesco kept reiterating at his press conference. And Johnston, he grew on me more throughout the process when I wasn't scouting him directly, when I was looking at Julius Brents, who went in the second round, and everybody's lauding the Julius Brents pick by the Colts because he's long and athletic and all that stuff, the Kansas State corner. Quentin Johnston torched him pretty consistently when they played. So Johnston can win on slants, he can win down the field, play to his strengths, and it's a big body target who's pretty fast and probably won't drop 12% of his targets consistently throughout his career. So I think it's a nice fit for what the Chargers already have on offense.
Yeah, I mean, I took the other side out of that matchup. It was more that's why I didn't love Julius Brents more than that's why I started to like Quentin Johnston more.
Yeah, both can be true.
Johnston, I think, I mean, he went kind of where I thought he should go. Like, we push back a lot on Quentin Johnston over the process, but it started because he was Mike Renner's number one wide receiver and a guy that was being talked about as, well, will he go number 12 to Houston or is he a top 10 type of wide receiver? And you're like, no, he isn't. But he's when you do the wide receiver rankings and you're like, I can't drop him that far. Like, I don't like him particularly as a prospect, but I can only really drop him below two guys before I run out of players where I think it's fair. The things that he's good at, like that size, that speed, that ability to catch a short pass, turn up field and make a big play out of it, that is rare. It's not easy to find that kind of skill set. So even if he's never going to have great hands or even if he's never going to be a good at the catch kind of receiver, there's still a role for it in the offense. And I think in the 20s is about where that should go, particularly in this draft. The only concern would be, as Chris mentioned on draft night, you know, there are two wide receivers that are ahead of him on the depth chart. Mike Williams and Keenan Allen have a pretty extensive injury history at this point each. If one of those goes down, if both of them go down, and all of a sudden Quentin Johnston is your number one wide receiver or has to be a much bigger part of the offense than you anticipate right now, then I think you might have some issues. But adding him to that group as the number three is a great fit.
Yeah, I mean, on paper, it looks awesome if Mike Williams and Keenan Allen are healthy. Yeah, I mean, if Quentin Johnston has to be fed more targets and be a bigger, you know, high volume player. Yeah, it's more challenging. And I know it's appealing to have a big body and you say, oh, red zone and all that stuff. We'll see what happens with Quentin Johnston. But theoretically, when you are trying to match up defensively in the red zone with Quentin Johnston, with Mike Williams, Donald Parham, 6'8", tight end, Chargers have some options there, right? So they are they're taking the idea that they have to build around Justin Herbert. I think Telesco did mention that a few times. He did cite also, as most evaluators are, you know, they trust their board, they're not picking needs and all that stuff. They are, but they're also knowing, hey, when we have three and four legitimate receivers and pass catchers for our quarterback, that's how you win in today's NFL. So I love the fact that they went that route with Johnston, where I do think that the big play upside is there. It was also a note during the press conference that they said, hey, what do you know, a lot of people said it, his hands as an issue. He said, yeah, he caught about He took drop rate and kind of inverted it, Telesco. He said, yeah, I think he caught 88% of his passes or something to that effect of catchable balls. And he's like, yeah, that needs to improve. Everybody needs to improve. So he acknowledged the drop rate, the hands issues, probably used our, we had him with 12% drops. He said 88% catch rate. So, yeah, I mean, that does need to get better. But we've also talked about sometimes guys have like a 5% drop rate one season and then it's 15% the next season. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't overrate the drops. The bigger issue with Quentin Johnston is, why does he not dominate at the catch point consistently? You're not getting a Mike Williams, right? He's Mike Williams type of size, but Mike Williams wins 50-60% of those balls, where Quentin Johnston in college was winning 30% of those.
Runner's theory is also pretty interesting, that Max Duggan, his quarterback, I mean, you hear throws a catchable ball a lot, which is generally just a made-up bullshitty term. But there are guys that do not throw catchable balls, like these guys that throw these knuckleball, the absolute antithesis of spirals, right? This weird sort of thing that's coming at you at a weird angle, not necessarily in a straight line, and you have to think about how you're going to catch it. You can't just automatically pluck it out of the sky without thinking, because it's coming the way it normally comes. It's coming at a slightly off angle. You need to maneuver your hand slightly. I'm not saying he's responsible for all of Quentin Johnston's struggles at the catch point. I am saying it's probably a factor that Max Duggan has not helped, and in fact has hindered how it looks like Quentin Johnston catches the football. And as soon as you put him next to a guy that's actually throwing a tight spiral every single play, he probably looks better.
Yeah, I'm sure there's something to that. Hopefully he doesn't get to see Max Duggan again. He is their seventh round pick here for the Chargers. We'll see him in the preseason most likely, but hopefully Justin Herbert is staying healthy and we get to see that combination. So definitely interested in what's going on at receiver. The two day two picks, Tuli Tuilapiloto out of USC, Diane Henley, another couple interesting prospects, right? The USC guy, Tuli, Brandon Staley did the day two press conference, or the one that I listened to. He was raving about him and his versatility. Could play the edge, could play on the interior, very productive player. And he's also only 20 years old.
Which is, I quite like Tuilapiloto, or at least I like him the most of the beige pass rushers in the middle of this draft. I will say, though, he might have the most extreme version of the list size not matching up to the real size. We talked about Rashee Rice being listed at like 6'2", 220 or whatever it was, and then being 6'1", 204. Tuilapiloto was listed at 6'4", 290 pounds, and actually measured...
It's misinformation.
6'3", so he's lost an inch, and 266 pounds. So 24 pounds lighter than he was supposed to be. Which, when you're talking about like tweener defensive linemen, you're no longer a tweener at that size. You're just an edge rusher.
He's just an edge. I mean, I do need to dig in further. I don't know if he pushed 290. He never looked like 290.
No.
I wonder if he pushed in the 280s.
Because he did.
At some point.
I mean, I agree with the tape that he did look like a guy that can play inside and outside and pretty much anywhere along the defensive line. But if he is just 266, and we're not talking about a guy that gets anywhere near 280, 290, 270, hell, I mean, you're not a guy that plays inside, at least not in any situation outside of like obvious pass rushing downs where it doesn't matter that you're only 260.
He's also big enough to at least rush from the interior on third down. So there is a world where it could be Tuli on the interior with Joey Bosa, Khalil Mack on the edge. You've got stunts and games and all that stuff that you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Big fan of rolling 3 and 4 deep with good edge rushers, right? So that makes a ton of sense. Again, Staley referenced his ability to play that 4 technique, head up on the tackle at USC, and how he played the run and was rugged and tough, and as far as, you know, shedding blocks and everything. So that's a good fit for the Chargers. Henley will play pure linebacker for the Chargers. Backup Eric Kendricks, Kenneth Murray. They just denied Kenneth Murray's fifth-year option, so it looks like Henley, you know, probably takes over for Kenneth Murray at least in 2024 at the earliest. Developmental wide receiver. He's a linebacker who used to play receiver. Really, really fast. He's an older prospect, but still somewhat young at the linebacker position, but a really good athlete to work with.
Yeah, I like that pick. I mean, I like bringing in a young, talented, athletic linebacker that Eric Kendricks can help bring along as well, along with Kenneth Murray, who they already have there.
And even though they only cited Darius Davis in his 4.36 speed as a return guy first, I mean, we've seen Herbert have success with just, you know, whether it was Jalen Guyton, you know, hey, fast guy, run fast as my number 4 receiver.
He's also
that's a position on NFL teams. The designated deep threat for 10 plays a game, Darius Davis could potentially do some of that.
Sure. He's also the only receiver on the roster, I think, that is small and shifty and quick. You know, like the kind of dinky receiver that most teams have somewhere as a gimmick threat. All the receivers for the Chargers are these giants. So, you know, maybe he can come in and be that short, quick, shifty guy that has – there's a role for that. Like, there's a gimmick gig somewhere for that.
And the other guy I just wanted to highlight, Jordan McFadden from Clemson. He – I didn't highlight him enough during the process. He might be, I think, along with Blake Freeland from BYU. I'm going to call those two the best developmental offensive linemen in the draft. Jordan McFadden could be another Jamari Sawyer. And McFadden is fascinating because he played at a really high level at Clemson, both tackle spots, right and left, at 6'2". And so when you see 6'2", it's like immediately he's got to be a guard. But he has 34-inch arms, so he at least has tackle length and all that stuff. Telesco called him a tackle and a guard, so they're not just pigeonholing him. Honestly think that he could compete for starting right tackle snaps with, depending on what they do with Jamari Sawyer.
Yeah.
If they keep Sawyer at guard or move him to guard, Trey Pipkins at right tackle, I really think Jordan McFadden can compete as a starting right tackle as a fifth-round pick. If not this year, then next year, I think he could be the best developmental tackle prospect in the draft class.
The Chargers appear to be showing a disregard for sort of traditional cookie-cutter measurable stereotypes for the offensive line. You've got Jamari Sawyer, who is built like a guard.
Yeah.
Injury forced it, but he was playing left tackle last year and doing pretty well for them when Rashawn Slater went down. You've got Rashawn Slater himself, who has 33-inch arms, which are right on that cutoff of NFL desirable measurables from an offensive tackle standpoint. They drafted him at the top of the draft, you know, in their first round, and he's an amazing left tackle right away. And then you have a guy like this who is a weird body type, 6'2", but long, you know, what do you do with that? So at least through three players, they look like they don't really care what your measurables are if you've shown the tape to play tackle or guard or whatever it is.
So Chargers draft, anything else? Max Duggan goes late. Again, 3 out of 7 players coming out of TCU.
Mm.
I like McFadden, though, in round 5. A- over at PFF.com for the Chargers. Thought it was solid.
Mm-hmm.
One of the A's up there.
Not a lot of undrafted free agents I love from the Wests. I haven't found a ton of players that I'm big on.
Yeah, why is that? Anybody good here? The Chargers? I'm looking. Jared Clark, the nose tackle out of Coastal Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
He's 330 pounds. He could – they need any sort of defensive tackle who could stop the run.
It's interesting that they didn't draft a running back. Remember, the Austin Ekeler wants out, wants to be traded, unhappy with his contract. They were a landing spot for Bijan Robinson back when we thought Bijan might last to the 20s.
Yeah.
Jahmyr Gibbs was a late push for them when we thought Jahmyr Gibbs might make it to the 20s. They didn't draft one at all. They didn't take a running back.
Man, they could have been in the they should have traded for DeAndre Swift and just stitch it together. Yeah, we'll see if Austin Ekeler ends up – I mean, if Eckler's still there – they're in pretty good shape. If they do end up trading him and he's that upset,
they brought in a couple as undrafted free agents. But, I mean, just a notable point that they did not, what we thought was one of their bigger area of needs, they didn't even touch it in the draft.
The other part, too, is we talked about the Cowboys as a multiple year, when are they going to get the big run-stopping nose tackle? We've talked about the same with the Chargers. All they got was Scott Matlock out of Boise State in the 6th. So they're rolling again this season as of right now with – the same guys as last year. Their free agent signings last year, Sebastian Joseph Day, Austin Johnson, could probably still use some more help up front as we head into the season. So That's it for the West, right?
Yep.
We hit every team?
Hopefully.
We're halfway through the league, man.
Easy.
East and West are done. What should we do tomorrow? South or North? What do you think?
I don't know.
I think we always do the South. Let's go the South tomorrow.
Okay.
South tomorrow.
That way we'll have a chance to fix it if you forget Tennessee again.
That's true. If I forget Tennessee, we'll get to them on Thursday. Mm-hmm. So we appreciate everybody for tuning in. We'll be live again tomorrow, presumably at our usual time, the 10:30 start tomorrow, Eastern time. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And, we'll see you for the next couple days. We're still reviewing the 2023 NFL Draft.